All right, thank you for coming this evening. Appreciate your attendance, and we finish up the last three or four lessons. This is the fourth last. We've got three more to go after tonight, and then we'll have a break for the summer. So we will continue. One of the difficulties in showing you pictures is you don't have a chance to see where these pictures were taken and get oriented to the landscape. So what I have up for you here is basically the Valley of Armageddon. We're going to talk about that tonight. It comes under three or four names: the Valley of Armageddon, Jezreel, Megiddo, the Valley of Ashkelon, are all referring basically to the same place. The term Armageddon is often related to the final battle and the location of the staging of the armies as they will assemble against the Messiah at the Second Advent. And the other ones are not as well known, just because they're known because of their villages that reside in the plains of the Valley of Jezreel. So in the Valley of Jezreel, there are major features. One is the valley, or the Mount Carmel mountain range, which I show here all schematic, more or less in relationship to each other. Mount Carmel range starts at the Mediterranean Sea and heads to the southeast, and on the west side of this valley ends with Mount Gilboa, and from there on to the further east we have the Jordan River. And in this large valley, maybe 15 miles across, we have from the east or from the north, depending how you look at it, the village of Nazareth, where Jesus was raised. We have Mount Tabor, which is a very notable mountain because it's very smooth and very symmetrically round. And we have Morah. Morah is another name in the middle. It's sort of a two-hump mountain. And we have other events in the plain here, like Gideon's army that were reduced to 400 or less. This is at Ain Herod. It's the spring of Herod. The Witch of Endor is from here, where Saul... Samuel was brought up from the dead by Saul when he was desperate for help. So those things, there are other things that happen in the plain here that are interesting. One of the major features of this plain along this Carmel mountain range is the valley, or Megiddo, which is a fort and is through a pass here. The pass is not very visible, although it is by the mountains, but in terms of its severity and it's a restriction, we really can't see it. We don't have a good... I have seen pictures of it when it was before it was opened up, but I could not find it. But we have pictures of the area, and so we have this location, which we'll talk about later, is the strategic spot in the world to be held in the Western world, because if you held a strategic spot, you pretty well control the commerce between the three continents. A small spot seems maybe like an overstatement, but we'll explain a little bit later. So we have the roads that go to Afula, makes a joint here, either go on to Jordan River in that direction or you go to Nazareth. We'll take this route this way, and we'll take a late route from Nazareth down to the Sea of Galilee, and that's where we'll end. We've had an introduction to the land, and so let's get into the slide presentation. We have three pictures here showing the Valley of Armageddon from Mount Carmel. It is an evening picture, which gives us the sunlight, and the sun shine from the back rather than looking into the sun, so it gives us a little better picture. But we do see a lot of haze, and so it's very difficult to get a good picture of Armageddon. Then we have the Galilean ministry area where we will end up. We see the road, if I can make this work here. We have a road down here, which is what we'll be traveling at the end of our lesson. So, Lord willing, that's the plan. And then we have, in the midst of this, we have the Mount of Precipice, where Jesus was threatened to be thrown off of in Nazareth. So these are the pictures that we'll, areas we'll cover tonight. And we don't have Megiddo up here, but that's a major spot as well. Last time we launched our tour of the land, we headed north out of Jaffa toward Caesarea. And it was a multi-leveled place. Remember, we saw Pilate there, Philip, the first, the early evangelist. We have Peter and Cornelius, the beginning the movement, not the beginning of the church, but the movement to allow Gentiles into the church. We have the Apostle Paul, who was on his missionary journey, came here at the end of his third missionary journey, where he had been arrested by the Jews, and they made an appeal to Caesar. And then we have the Crusaders around, between 1100 and 1300. So we have much more modern antiquities there as well. On your right, you see a picture of the hotel we'll be staying at in the 2017 trip, and it's about a 20-minute walk from Caesarea. I mention that here because this is a new place. We have never stayed here before. And if we still have enough energy after a long day, you could walk in, probably a 20-minute walk you over to the Caesarea shore. And so today, we do move away from the Mediterranean Sea. And before we do that, we have a few last looks. This is a picture from Charles Feinberg's library. He was the senior, and their two sons, who I think are even older than I am. So when Charles was a teacher at Trinity in Deerfield, Illinois, he was a very lover of the Jews. He made many, I think he's 8 trips to Israel, and spent some time there as a Jew evangelist to the Jews, and he took pictures. So we have older picture here of Tel Aviv from Jaffa, and I thought it's very interesting to note the change there has been over the years, the 50 years, from the way it looked then and to the way it looks now. You see, it's a much more developed city, and it's just remarkable. And we have another picture of Tel Aviv looking to the south. We have Jaffa sticking out into the Mediterranean Sea here, indicates where Jaffa is. And it's a shoreline is still pretty primitive. Remember, this is only about 12 years, if it's 60 is correct, only 12 years after Israel's independence. So we have a lot of this stuff would be undeveloped yet. And to see some of these things are really pretty run down and not very attractive. And you know that today this beachfront property is worth a lot more than it looked like in those days. So interesting days. And then we have a spot along the Mediterranean Sea to the south of Caesarea. And if you remember, we talked about the ships bringing coal from Australia, they unload this on this dock. And again, you may see it here, load on the dock here. And so we're further south now, so we're looking back north. And you see this unusual figure of this large rock. This is, again, Netanya. And so you have these varied looks along the Mediterranean coast, which everybody enjoys water. We did a farmer's tour in February 2012, and so people that can't go in the summertime could go in the wintertime. So we get up in the morning, the first day of our tour, look out the window and say, wow, it's rainy and it's stormy. We're going to go out on this kind of thing. Yes, we are. So we did, and it ended up being a fine day, although a little bit of a nuisance rain, we sometimes call it, is not pouring down, but it was just wet. Anyway, we see the strong winds coming in off the onto the coast from the west, and stirs up the water and makes it look quite ferocious. Here it comes quite far onto the land as we looked from our hotel window. We thought about the Apostle Paul being shipwrecked in the sea, and also later on we'll talk about Elijah and hoping or God is going to provide rain for him. And this little cloud comes out of the west. Well, this is where the little cloud comes from, and it moves into the land and brings a downpour to break the drought there in Israel. Anyway, picture from a hotel. Before we get too far into our Jewish part of our trip, we do want to talk a little bit about the Arabs. We have Arabs that live throughout the land, and we start our trip. These pictures I'm going to show you, we start here at Netanya, and we head up this way and across this road to Megiddo. And of course, here's the Valley of Armageddon we've talked about, and it stretches clear down to here. So that's the angle, makes it very difficult sometimes to understand exactly which direction you're looking. Anyway, this is the road we're going to be on, and we have interest in people live in this area. And there are Arab people that live in Israel that are not Palestinian refugees. They're full-blown Arab citizens of Israel. So who did not evacuate their homes in the War of Independence in 1948, of the War of Independence, continued to live in their homes and own them as an Israeli would. Now, you happen to be looking at a Druze leadership here. They are noted easily because of the white caps they wear, and then they have a little color that they, you know, if it's red up there, red in their inlay in the top of their cap, then there's some high-level religious leader in their group. So that's why you don't see these a lot. There's not that many of them in Israel. Talk a little bit about how many there are. But that's who these people are, and that's where they live. And this is how they live. We see they live in nice homes. They're not like the shacks we'll see later on when we get into what's called the West Bank and see the squalor that those people live in. These are well-to-do. They have jobs. They have businesses, and in some ways you probably wouldn't recognize one from a Jewish person living down the road. So the war of, to give a little history here, the war of 1948, the War of Independence left many Arabs, many Arabs left the land expecting to return to reclaim their homes. But wartime rules apply when being attacked by a belligerent nation. Those sympathetic to the invaders give up the right to their property when they, in effect, abandon their rights or their homes and take the position of the belligerent nation. So they become an enemy, really, of the state, become possibly a third column within the nation. So they were not allowed to return, which is no different than what happened in America when it declared its independence. Those that were still royal to the British crown had to, in a sense, swear allegiance to the United States, or they had to leave. They couldn't be here fomenting unrest in a new fledging state. So no new thing here for Israel, although it looks like, by listening to the news, this has never happened before, but it has happened many, many times. So again, picture of these homes that are really quite nice. So we're driving through this Arab village where Arabs live in their homes. They did not abandon them or their nation when they found themselves, you know, in Israel, because it was a partition by the UN. And when the United States recognized Israel as a state, they became citizens of a new country if they remained there. So now they are citizens of Israel. And all the Arabs have full rights. The only thing they don't do is serve in the military. And the exception there again with the Druze, they do serve in the military. So the Druze are a little different group of people, which we'll talk about later. So in this map, we have locations where these Arabs live. I've been talking about this area here, and we look over here and see this kind of area where we're talking about. So our route is from up here through this way, and that's, so we're just cutting across one of these areas where these dark areas are where Arabs live, Arab-speaking people. And percentage-wise, you can see there's quite a few, but they're not everywhere, and I'm sure these are mixed areas. Especially here in the north, you'll find some more. And here in Jerusalem, this is considered East Jerusalem on the side here. So you'll find more there. So there are quite a few, and I have some demographics for you in a minute. So this is called the West Bank. Inside here, if there's an Arab living in this area, they are called Palestinians, or they're called, by the misnomer, Palestinian refugees. But at least they're people without land. They're squatters. They're not having any rights to any land. Different on the other side, which I've just shown you. So this is called the West Bank, and they don't even show us in this map how many people of the Palestinian variety are, because they have no rights to the land. So then, in a sense, they're just the squatters. Now, these lines we show here are the routes that we took in this trip that we did in, I think it's 2008. We stayed at Netanya and went to Caesarea, and then we came back here to Netanya for a night, and then we headed back this way. And then we head up north to Mount Carmel, where Elijah challenges the prophets. And then across the valley here, we go to Nazareth. And then we have, as I mentioned on the board over there, we have Nazareth, Tabor. We have the Morah, the mountain, Mount Gilboa over here, somewhere here, there, right there. So this is how those mountains line up. And then so the valley, as I said, is really basically this line here. It goes, you know, to the Jordan River to the south, west, and then the Kishon River flows to the northeast, northwest. This is southeast to the northwest, and dumps into the Mediterranean Sea. So there's a ridge in this that makes the water flow different ways. Okay, still on the same idea here. The dark areas are where Jews cannot go. The yellow areas where Jews and Arabs Palestinians can go. We're talking here in the West Bank. The West Bank really is this area that is like this. So we don't have any of these kind of restrictions outside of the West Bank. That's where the Arabs live. They live in full citizenship. But live in this area, they do not. So these Arabs you're talking about are about 1.6 million, or 20% of the population. Of those, they're mostly Sunni Arabs. 83% of the people are are Islamic, and Christianity is 8%. The Druze Muslims are only about 8%, so they're relatively small. And of course, Christianity would count everybody, you know, Christian that are born again and Catholics, whatever, as long as they're not considered, you know, as long as they consider themselves Christian. the Palestinian Authority administers these areas of these dark gray and these yellow areas, and the Jews do not. The Jews administrate everything else. However, the Jews do have rights to go into any of these areas to keep the peace or to knock out terrorism. So there is this kind of an imaginary line or authority that resides with Israel no matter where you are in the land. So they really have sovereignty over everything. And the place that I just mentioned, we drive along here and see the Arabs, and we get to Megiddo, where we're going. I'd mentioned the Druze. This is in the Golan Heights. We were there in the wintertime, and it did snow, very unusual. It snowed quite a bit, in fact. And our bus driver had no idea what to do with it, and even a good bus driver could not have made it up the hill with this kind of snow, because as soon as the tires slip on snow, you slid into the little guardrail, and that's what we did, and we were stuck until somebody came and pulled us out, which delayed us about 2 hours. But it was an interesting experience, one of those things you never forget. And this lady is a Druze Muslim lady with her son, and he's painted up because of, Esther's celebration. I forget the name of the celebration right now, but they do that. Anyway, she has her son in a Jewish school. So there's a lot of good feeling between the Druze Muslims and the Jews, and she was very willing to pose for us as she was enjoying the snow. Very unusual experience, I'm sure, for those people. So there are 130,000 of these Druze Muslims. There's a large community at Mount Carmel. You drive through it from a different route. We drove in. You'll see them. And then we have a large community here in the Golan Heights, and we'll talk about them a little bit more later on. We'll have lunch with their Masad. This is different than a Masada, which we have down in the southern part of Israel, where Israel went after for the protection from the Romans. So this is a different place, but looks, you say it the same way. All right, the three areas, the Mount Carmel range, the Valley of Megiddo, Valley of Armageddon, or the Valley of Jezreel, Ascalon, could put that up as well. So we want to talk about the Kidron Valley and the Kishon Pass. The Kishon River basically would be this. And today it's a really small river. Most of the water is being preserved and collected in pools used for irrigation later. There's a pass we talked about a number of times that goes right through the Carmel Mountain Range. So this pass is a great place to defend, and Megiddo is right outside that, probably a quarter mile from the pass. So that's why Megiddo is there, and it's a long-standing fort, which we'll talk about. So that's it. Now, it's very hard to show you this pass, and I'm not even sure sometimes where these pictures are from, because not all a lot of them are not my pictures. But this shows a pass through here, and of course we're sitting low on the ground, you can't see it very well. But there would have been a pass that was so, in the ancient days, it would have been so narrow that only one horse could go through at a time. Now, I don't think that's that spot here, but in this range of the mountains, the Carmel Mountain Range. And now we see it's full of vegetation, and they take as many as three crops off the land. Okay, now, when we came from Caesarea, this is the road we would have driven on. We would have come around this way, going off into Megiddo. And we'll show you that in a minute. But that's the road we came in. But the pass would have been this way, and it still is a not a formidable pass like we went through the Rocky Mountains, but again, it's narrow, and to drive a large army through this one at a time, but very slow. And along the Mediterranean coast, you have the Carmel Mountain Range actually goes right into the sea, so you have no shoreline where you could drive. So this became the route of the Via Maris. You know, the Via Maris actually is a route that goes from Damascus to Cairo, Egypt, and it part of the way it follows the sea, and that's why the name Via by the Sea route is. So that's what this is. This is a strategic point on the Via Maris. And later on we'll talk about Elijah, and it didn't rain in Israel for many years, and I saw a little bit of dryness here. But behind it all, we see this pass again, and I can't tell you exactly where it is, but there's a road here this way, and maybe the pass is this way. So anyway, just want to make you aware of the importance of this spot because of the restriction of travel. Well, kind of Mount Carmel, we find here in one of Feinberg's picture, 1960, and this is Maraca, sometimes with a K, monastery. And this is where you visit. This is not how it looks today. In fact, it looks quite different. But this is on the place where we go visit and overlook the Megiddo or the Valley of Armageddon. When you come to the site, you see the statue of Elijah and slaying the Baal prophets. So King Ahab, he was a bad king in the northern tribes. There was no good king in the northern tribes. And Ahab was a particularly bad king, and he had a particularly bad wife named Jezebel. And so he has this thing with Elijah. So typically of the unregenerate, Ahab sees everything upside down. And when Ahab sees Elijah, he calls him the troubler of Israel. But Elijah turns around on Ahab and says, your father's house has troubled Israel because you have followed the Baals. His gentle wife Jezebel brought false worship to Israel. So there, Elijah's not the troubler of Israel. Ahab was. Well, Ahab's an important person here. Well, this introduces the contest of the gods. Elijah is brought here to do this. And so I'm going to say Elijah has had enough of the Baals. You might say that God has had enough of the Baals. And so he's going to have a once and for all contest with them. So now then send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel. Gather together 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So you see Jezebel's the one that supports these prophets, these false prophets. And now, interesting that the Israelites are not sure who to follow here. You think, well, it'd be a given. But as it always is, Israelis are sometimes hard to figure out. You know, why doesn't one of them take the obvious option? The Israelites are unsure who to follow when Elijah sees this, and he issues a clear choice. Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. It's really a strange thing. You know, it seemed like they'd all, well, of course they're going to follow God. They're God's chosen people. They're one that God has blessed. And so they sit there and don't know what to say. Well, obviously there's a lesson need to be learned here, and that's what we're going to get into here. So Elijah takes a little accounting, and he notices he's one against 450 plus 400, makes 850 people. 1 Kings 18:23 talks about the contest, how it is set up. And he said, now let them give us two oxen and let them choose one ox for themselves and cut it up and place it on the wood and put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other ox and lay it on the wood and I will not put fire under it. Two things that are exactly alike. And when you call the name of the God of your God, I will call on the name of the Lord and the God who answers by fire. He is the God of all people. And all the people, he is the God. And all the people said, that is a good idea. It's kind of a sweet lay of supporting this contest. They'd kind of like to know who they should follow, I guess. And they took the ox which was given them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon. O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice. There was no one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they made. And it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, call out with loud voice, you know, a louder voice, for he is a God, remember? And either he is occupied or gone aside. Get his attention. Do something. Or he's on the way. Or perhaps he has gone aside, you know, going to a bathroom. That's really, you know, sticking it to him. A sleeper needs to be awakened. So they cried out with a loud voice and cut themselves to bleed. According to the customs, the swords, lances, the blood gushed out of them, like as if that would cause God to pay attention to them. Well, when midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. There was no voice, and no one answered, and no one paid attention. So, you know, the God they were praying to obviously doesn't exist, and so they're caught with nothing. And now it's Elijah's turn. He said to the people, come near me, come watch this thing. So all the people came near to him and repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. And Elijah took stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, Lord, Israel shall be your name, which is kind of recounting their history. So with stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold two measures of seed. And he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill four pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And he did it the third time. And there was so much water, it flowed around the altar that also filled the trench with water. So we have a drenched, wet, unlightable sacrifice with its wood. So at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah and the prophets came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God and that you have turned their heart back again. Hopefully that's what will happen. I'm not sure it did. When the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones, burned the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. Now that is different than what these other guys experienced. So when the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And Elijah said to them, Seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let them escape, or one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon, slew 850 there, and that was the end of the Baals, at least for the time being. So the contest of the gods happened in this vicinity. There are places that are suggested. We have this section down here. It's kind of like an olive grove. It's a flat area that has been suggested as a place. You know, we look at this valley. We're quite a ways away. Again, the particular lens you make makes it look like it's further than it actually is. And then up here we have the monastery that we stand and look over. So anyway, this probably in the vicinity, and I got some more to show you. But we're looking over the Valley of Armageddon, looking mostly towards the north. Another picture of it. And we see in the background here, we see an Israeli Air Force, Bay Air Force Base, and it is part of their defense system, and you do hear airplanes fly out of there, and you hear them overhead, and there's nothing built above the ground. Everything's underground, so you don't see anything except the runways. There's a picture of the group, whichever group it was, and we were having the story of Elijah being told them. Now, the Kishon River looks like this probably more or less today. It's not a very big river today because most of the water is being taken out. Let's see the olive trees on the sides. And had the Kishon River pointed out here, this is without the trees, and it flows, us, as I said, to the left would be to the west, goes toward the Mediterranean Sea. You see this agricultural area. This is the breadbasket of Europe. And they have water. They preserved it. Remember, it used to be all swamp. They've tiled it, take the water out of the water, take the water out of the land, out of the soil, so they can farm it. Another picture of the Kishon River. And we're looking probably more towards the north rather than towards the south. Towards the west, I'm sure west, north. And again, it's at an angle. It's a little hard to tell which direction we're looking. Now we're down lower, and we look up to this, the monastery up here where we make our, have a vista of the valley and the place where the where the contest occurred, suggested that this is an older picture. You can see the trees aren't as well developed. So somewhere along this hillside, this is the monastery, somewhere along the hillside is where this contest occurred. So this is Todd Bolin from the Bible Places. He says, this is probably the best view of the area of Elijah's contest. Assuming tradition is correct, the monastery of Muraka is at the top of the hill, but tradition places the contest slowly lowered near a spring. The crowds of Israelites would have filled the spacious territory around to see whose God would win. And, of course, we know who did, but somehow that didn't last forever. Now, the Valley of the word Armageddon is a fearful word for everybody in the Western world. At least we've seen movies made of Armageddon, named Armageddon. They talk about Armageddon as an expression of some disaster, and that's all, you know, well-placed. It's a word that comes out of Revelation 16:16, where it says, the last days, in the last days of the tribulation, they gathered them together, this would be the nations of the world, to the place which in Hebrew is called Armageddon. We just say Armageddon. And we're not going to go into the details of this tonight, but it seems like the best way to look at the plain of Armageddon is not necessarily where the battle itself is fought, except that there no doubt will be some battles fought there. But the big battle probably is in Jerusalem at the Valley of Jehoshaphat. But this becomes then the staging area where the nations gather and begin their assault on the Messiah. So it starts here in Babylon and moves over the salt and over to Jerusalem. And then we have those that flee Jerusalem out of the Mount of Olives. When it splits in two, they get down to Petra. So that's this route here All right, so we're going to talk too much more about that, but that's no, the better picture of that. Okay, now this is a good picture of the valley, and you see this is the Carmen Mountain Range, and this hook over here, this is Gilboa, and over here we find, well, here's Tabor, and Nazareth would be up here, and the Jordan River Valley, Sea of Galilee. And as I said, the armies really can't go around the end here, so they really had to go through Megiddo here through a pass, which doesn't hardly show here. So anyway, this is the Haifa is out here, and now this becomes a modern-day port for Israel. Now, this is a great picture. I don't know who did it or how they did it, but maybe they stitched it together to give this nice landscape. But we have basically what I have on the board over here. We have Tabor to the left, Nazareth to the left, Tabor, Mount Moriah, and then we have this valley between, and we come to Gilboa. And the arrow is in approximately the eastern direction, although my senses are always messed up there, but that's really, as it worked out, probably the right direction. Sometimes these fields give you an indication of what is north and south, because a lot of times the fields are laid out according to the points of the compass. So here we have the Valley of Armageddon. Valley of Megiddo, Plain of Jezreel, Plain of Ashkelon, right before Ais. And this is the road that we will take. You drive up to this way, you go to Mount Carmel, and you go to the right, you go down, make a hook, turn to the left, and we go to Nazareth. Get pictures of Armageddon just to familiarize yourself. Now we're looking a little bit towards the north-northwest. We see Nazareth now is on the right side, so we're looking a little bit more. But you see it's pretty consistent. It's a flat space. Let's kind of zoom in on the airfield. And Tabor and Moriah borders it. And again, you see there's really nothing above ground here that you see that's of any significance like an air base. So it's all underground, of course, for security reasons. And you see a lot of haze in the area. A little bit towards to the right, we see Moriah on this plain till Gilboa. You see the airfield over here. Keep on going. You can almost see the Jordan mountain range across Jordan River, rather. Another picture of the same. Okay, Megiddo now, like Armageddon, almost becomes a fearful idea. And the question is a little bit about what happens there. We have in Revelation 14:19, the judgment at the end of the tribulation, where it says in Revelation 14:19, so the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters of the vine of the earth and threw them into the great vine press of the wrath of God. Now, the question is the Armageddon here the vine press, or is it the Valley of Jehoshaphat? Well, a couple of problems with both of them to know which one it is. The wine press was drawn down outside the city, so it seems like it's almost related more to the city of Jerusalem than here, because there are cities here, but when it says the city, you sort of think that it's probably referring to Jerusalem. And blood came out from the wine press up to the horse's bridle. So we're talking about, 4 feet, perhaps three to 4 feet, or some say it splashed up that high. It's hard to know exactly what's meant here. And then the other real problem is for a distance of 200 miles. So this is a long distance. So that's why this 200 miles condition has made some of the commentators think it has to be the Jordan River, because if you take the Jordan River and you walk along the edge of it, it's 60 miles, but you stretch it out, take all the wiggles out of it, you have 200 miles, and some have made that point. So it must be referring to the Jordan River. If it's Valley of Jehoshaphat in Jerusalem, which seems to be more appropriate, you have the water that comes out of the Kidron Valley, which is the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and it flows down to the Dead Sea about the middle way down on the west side, and it doesn't flow 200 miles. And if you take all the distance clear down to Petra, it may be close to that, but I don't think it's quite 200 miles. So this leaves a kind of a question exactly what's being referred to here. I should say where it's being referred to. We have no temptation to spiritualize any of this. We just sometimes don't know an answer to a question. And that's perfectly all right, because you make a mistake because you can't find the answer, that's worse. So it's better to say, I don't know, than make a mistake and spiritualize. Well, this is just a spiritual thing. We don't really expect any literal fulfillment here. When it's all done and said and done, we'll be able to look back and say, oh, I understand now completely what the Lord meant here. We just didn't know about this or that, and now we do. It makes total sense. So it's one kind of questions I leave sort of open to be discovered later. Okay. So the fort, Tel Megiddo, and here's a great picture of it. I mean, I'm talking about the backhoe. No, it's not a great picture of the backhoe, but it is. But the real great picture of the Mount Telma Ghetto, and without those vehicles in front, it would have been a great picture because you really have a good idea the size of it and the elevation of it. So we have to stand with it. I didn't Photoshop it out, too much work. So there it is. And in the visitor center, they have a model of it. And gives you an idea of what it would look like. Again, these tells are built on ruined cities, on ruined cities, on ruined cities. And as you know, that Megiddo is one of those places where there was a lot of ruin. And so it ends up being a relatively high tell. Now, they no doubt started already on a bump. They wouldn't have built on a flat plain. They would have had some kind of hill. And Jerusalem has been destroyed, you know, in the 20s of times, and it seems to me like the Tal Megiddo has been destroyed that many times as well. So it was around really pretty much throughout the Old Testament period up until Solomon and so forth. So, and Ahab was here and so what, until the Babylonians took it in 586 or somewhere in there, 605, 586 in that period of time when Israel was taken captive. Anyway, there we have a picture of that, a couple of Jewish guys that are discussing some point. I'm sure that I couldn't hear because I'm sure they're talking Hebrew. All right. Well, let's read a little bit about this tell. Tel Megiddo is the key location on the Via Maris. Remember, it goes from Damascus down to Cairo. As the Romans called the Sea of the Road, the Sea Road that led from Egypt to Damascus. It has a long history of upheavals and conquests. The nearby spring and fertile ground drew settlers from the earliest ages to antiquity. It was a city with formidable walls. And they see 5,000 years old. That can't be. The flood occurred about 2,500 BC. So we could say maybe 4,500 years at the most, and probably take off a couple hundred years. Egypt was probably building their pyramids around 2,000, 2,200, something like that. Abraham lived at 2,000. BC, so we're just, you know, take those numbers for what they are. They usually start civilization around 3000 BC because that's when they think people learned to write and all that kind of stuff. So you have 5000, just generally how everybody starts talking. That's when, you know, civilization started to be recorded. So people started to write and so forth. 1000 years later, it fell under Egyptian rule. That's pretty close. That'd get you, you know, if I say 3000 to 2000, that'd be about right. But 5,000 to 4,000 is still wrong. So we got to start with 3 would be better. So 1,000 years after 3 gets you down to 2,000. And that's right. That's where Egyptian rule would have occurred. And then the Canaanites conquered this city, followed by King David, who had the conquest of Joshua first. And then his son Solomon fortified the city, and it reached heights of its power under King Ahab. And that was 2,900 years ago. Ahab returned Megiddo to, and I don't know what that word means, and built impressive waterworks, which we'll have a chance to look at. So the Israeli Megiddo fell to the Syrians in 732, and it finally was demolished by the Egyptians just before the Babylon conquest, which was 605. We've had these many layers over these years. Now we have gates that are sometimes called the Solomic gates. And they're like kind of notches of a gear, you know, they're in and out like this. So you'd have about 3 of these little vacant places that you could walk past and where warriors could stand. And when the enemy would come through, you could, you know, kill them. And if you didn't get them on the first one, you get them on the second one. You get them on the second one, you got them on the third one. So these became gates for horses, for chariots, not necessarily for pedestrians. We have other places where they could get in that would be smaller. But you could bring in something like a chariot or wagon with materials on it, and you needed a wider gate, and so you need a different kind of defense. So Solomon is credited for creating these gates, and when you see them other place in Israel, if we have time, we'll see them south, and they're also considered Solomon. But again, as in archaeology, no one ever believes everybody else, so some say, well, they were before Solomon. Actually, the Assyrians built them. So in archaeology, it's always a big if about stuff, unless the Bible has revealed it, we don't know for sure. But we're going to give Solomon the credit for it because he was one of the wisest men that ever lived. All right. So a little bit of picture of this inset here. You go this way, then it goes back, and it goes back like this and comes like this. And this goes around, and this one back, and like this, and it comes back out. And there's either one behind me or there's one at the end here yet where it goes back and outs. And it was, there's usually three of them like this. And you also want to notice here, take off these marks, want to notice these wooden ties. This is actually described in the Bible. This is how these, that's how construction occurred. Because they usually had three rows of stone like this, and then they had a row of wood. Well, that has a lot of sense, because wood is a little more flexible than our stone is. So if there was an earthquake, you know, that wood could take a lot of the shock and a lot of the movement, so everything wouldn't come falling down. And it also just tied things together, because you have wood that can be 3 or 4 feet, 5 feet long, and it's difficult to have a stone that long. And you see this stone here bridges a number of rocks, stones, whatever you want to call them, and it ties it, and it works as a tie. So we'd have these every three courses. You see them over here on this side as well. So that's a very common construction motif that you will, we've seen it at other places we'll see later on our trip. And, of course, all the buildings are gone, but you do see, you know, like, rocks here. And some of these things could have been rebuilt, and it's difficult to say. Sometimes they mark what's been rebuilt and what's been found. You usually have a line on the stone. Below that's original, and above that's been restored. So right now, of course, there's nothing of the superstructure left. Here's an entrance for pedestrians, and you see they make these cornered entrances, again, for safety. So you don't just have a straight shot in with an arrow. You have to go around the corner. So we have that one. We have this one as well. And all the this material here, no doubt, has been filled in here. Otherwise, you know, you have to walk down to get into this lower level. So there's been some erosion and dust come into these spots. So we're at the top of the tell, and it's really kind of flat. You see where their building used to be, the places where they feed horses and so forth, because they did have a stable. Now, this is a nice picture with the wide-angle lens. Gives a little bit of a distortion, but you do see the entire grain storage facility. And these are steps that you can walk down, and as the grain was depleted, you'd have to go lower and lower and lower, and you could go clear to the bottom and gather up the last kernel if you had to. So these grain storage, I'm sure it would have been covered somehow to keep the weather out, but of course that's all gone at this point. What the most amazing place about this place is Ahab's tunnel, a water system, and we're going to walk down this way, and we're going to come across this way and out this way. And this is really quite remarkable, because these this is about 80 feet deep. This is about 225 feet long, and we come up maybe 50 feet, something like that, at the end here, because you see it's a lot lower than this. And this is, I'll show you this picture here, the numbers down here, meters, take 3 1/4 times that, and gives you the actual distance in feet. So Ahab did this, and you look in the tunnel and you look on top of it and you see all these chisel marks, and you think, wow, those chisel marks were put there some, what, 2,025, 2,700 years ago, and they're still there. And somebody with an hammer, with a stone hammer probably, an iron hammer, with chiseling away there, make this water access possible. Of course, they do this because the water was outside the city walls. And so if you make this tunnel, you can get to the water from within the city walls and cover up the original water source. In other words, cover this all up, and then your enemy can't find the water source. And so you're really, if you have your water, you know, you saw the granary, how big granary it was. So they would have food stuff and water. They could outlast the siege for many, many times, many, many years. So we start down this large step, and this is one of the places where the few people say, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stay on the bus and ride around and not do the walk. But very few people have done that. Most people do, they, you know, buck it up and go down. So what you see here is the descent into this 80-foot down pit to the water. Of course, if you were living there, you'd have to have your bucket or your pail or whatever vessel to go down and get the water and then carry it all the way back up. So I guess your legs probably were used to these kind of exercises. So this continues on down. This continues on a level, and you can still hear water, sometimes seawater down below here. But the water level really has been lowered because all the water is being taken out by the farmers, so the water table has dropped, and they put that water in these pools that are collected. But in the days when Ahab was doing this, no doubt there would have been water sitting here, and they wouldn't walk down the tunnel to get the water. It would come out to this end. And we see now the putrid water, which is, you never want to drink that. But, you know, like I said, it's all pretty well gone. And but this is where the water would have been. And now from this point, you go back up to the outside. So here was the water, is right down here. And so you see the way out isn't nearly as bad as the way in, although I don't know, going down to something that's just as hard as going up, but I think you puff a little more when you go up. It's a little easier on your knees going up than when you come down. And this is where we're walking out, and you see how much dirt has been removed, you know, to get access to the exit here. So they were really pretty safe, very, very secure. Again, we're talking about the most secure, the most important place in the known world is Megiddo. So it would have these features of invincibility. The information center, we look back up to the tell. Okay, now we're going to head across the Jezreel Plain. We're going to be heading, see where Megiddo is. We're going to head up to Afula, make a little left-hand turn, go to Nazareth. So you can look at these signs here. There's Afula, the name there, and the Tiberias is there. And that's the way you're going to go. And it gives you the Highway 65. You got one of the maps. I did put my maps up. Have one of the maps. You can look at the map exactly where you are and follow the route. I always make a practice of taking signs, pictures of signs, because on there you have where you are, tell you the road you're on, because later on you do kind of lose track. I think we saw this. I just brought this back just in case we wondered about it. This is the road we're traveling as we go on to Nazareth. We're going to make a hook and then head back this way. That's the idea. Just to show you that picture, I think it's taken from here. You have Nazareth, you have Tabor, you have Mora, and we have Mount Gilboa kind of lined up here. And so the only way that I can make that work is looking at it pretty much from the straight west, looking straight east, and that works pretty well. Okay, so if we visit these places, look how they work on the compass points. So here is Megiddo, here's Nazareth, straight east, not Megiddo, of Mount Carmel, and then in this little corner, we have Megiddo straight south on this compass point. Roads are very nice, as you can tell. I think anybody could drive here that was a normal, careful driver. Mount Mora, Tabor, Nazareth. We're heading to that Afula Junction there, and that's where we're going. We'll take a picture north. Excuse the reflection of the bus windows. So obviously it's my picture. But the land is flat. That's why it's considered such a great place for military maneuvering. Now we approach Nazareth. We approach it pretty much going straight north. And we want to see this point here as we get closer. It's called the hill, Mount of Precipices, where Jesus is going to be threatened to be thrown off. And I always think about mountains. When you're looking up at them, they don't seem so high. They don't seem so scary. But you look from the top down, all of a sudden that changes. So again, this is a picture of it. And I want to point out here this cut. This is a huge cut. In fact, you could see it. I should have pointed out earlier picture. But you see this yellow cut on a lot of pictures when you look towards Nazareth. So it's made for a road. But still, it's not all of what they've done. They've made bridges. We'll show you in a minute. So they have spent a lot of money to preserve the culture or the landscape as much as possible. So let's talk about Nazareth a little bit. When Jesus, this little baby, comes back to the land, Joseph, the father, is aware that he can't go back to Bethlehem. He can't go back to the Jerusalem area because he had heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea, a place in place of his father Herod, and he was afraid to go there. And then after he was warned by God in a dream, he left the region of Galilee and came and lived in a city called Nazareth. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene. So that's how Jesus gets to Nazareth. He gets there as a baby, as an infant, taken there by his father. Now, Nazareth is not a splendor or a spectacular city. You know, they said of Jesus, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And you sort of take a look at this, and it ends up being a palace, an Arab town today, and not a Palestinian town, an Arab town. An Arab town, they're all right, but they're not as nice as when the Jews actually developed them. So we're looking a little bit towards the west. And then I think I have another one. Nazareth is considered a bowl. It sat in a bowl, and you sort of see that here. And in the middle of the bowl here is this Church of the Annunciation. Supposedly, that's the church where marked a spot. Or let's say it commemorates the fact that Jesus, the birth of Jesus, was announced to Mary. And so that's why they call the Church of the Annunciation, never been in it. But so here we have Nazareth, you know, a no nothing city because it's undefensible, and it never ends up being anything, and now occupied by Arabs. But this is a place that has interesting note in the Luke, in the Gospel of Luke, and they're getting the picture. Now, this is the beginning of Jesus' ministry. We see this is in Luke chapter 4, and Jesus apparently has already gotten some notoriety as a rabbi, and when he came to Nazareth visiting in the early part of his ministry, where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue. They probably knew him on the Sabbath and stood up to read, and the book of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him, and he opened the book and found the place where it was written, quote, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor." Now, the poor is not those economically poor. These are the spiritually poor. "And he who sent me to proclaim the release to the captives." These are not the people that are in jail for a crime. They're captives because of their faith. "And recover the sight of the blind," spiritually blind, "and to set free those who are oppressed," spiritually oppressed. And he will even recover the blind of those that are physically blind. But the point here is the spiritual recovery here. "And then to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." And he closed the book. Jesus closed the book and gave it back to the attendant, and he sat down. And all the eyes of the synagogue were fixed on him, and began to say to them, "Today scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Now that's got to be a remarkable thing, that this man, this upstart man, would come in, read the Bible, said, "That's me." And they took offense at that. And when all the people of the synagogue were filled with rage as they heard these things, they got up and drove him out of the city and led him to the brow of the hill on which the city had been built, and they ordered to throw him down the cliff. That's what they're going to do. But he said he passed in their midst and was on the way. So here's the cliff. I think this is probably the right place. Now, we have a nice picture across the valley of Armageddon, Jezreel Valley, and look towards Megiddo. This is the road we came in on. And this road here is straight north. Gives you an idea of the direction. Here's that Morah sign, and to the left is Tabor. Over the hill over here is Gilboa. All right, you see these ponds of water sitting here. Just mentioned that. That's where they collect the water. All right, these rocks are really vicious. I always find that the rocks in Israel are often like this. They're just, if you fall on a rock like that, you just can't imagine how you even survive. So they are that kind of, not smooth rock, but it's hard to walk on them. You trip on them easily. And looking over the edge, you get a little bit of an idea of the elevation, and I'll have another picture for you to show how steeply it drops off. But the road we came in, I was on below, is below here, and again, I pick out the Mount Carmel Range, Megiddo, in the direction that's south. And in the wintertime, this is how it looks on a rainy day, not quite as attractive, less, more cold, probably in the 50-degree temperature range, and everybody's got their coats on, but you're still in the place where Bible events occurred, and some of our folks were on our trip that day, and I was always apologizing for the weather so bad, you know, it's not so good. "Oh, no, we love it. It's just okay. We're here. Don't worry about it. We just love to be in Israel, even when it rains." So we enjoyed the tour. Got a picture of it in a different time of the year. We saw the snow already earlier. So there's our approach. They're building elevated roads just to avoid some of the destruction to the land, to the landscape. So we appreciate that, even though they made a huge cut to do this, to get us here. Again, more on the back. And again, more on the back. And see, again, these rough road, rough rocks. And then we have this one that really shows the drop-off here. And you don't want to get too close because you really would tip over. You'd fall that far. You'd keep on going. And it would be, for Jesus, it was a life-threatening, they intended to kill him there. All right. So we have Mount Tabor, the Mount of Transfiguration, traditional. I think it's impossible this is the place, because when Jesus was transfigured, and it would be a number of days walk just to get here. So we'll talk about that when we get there. But this is the traditional spot of Tabor, the Mount Tabor, and there's a monastery at the top and so forth. But, you know, since it's a traditional spot, I would show it to you. And it's a very noteworthy mountain because it's so round, you can't miss it. Whenever you look at it, you see it. Oh, that's Tabor. There's no mountains quite like that. Now we're going to head towards Tiberias, and remember the mountain ranges on the south go north and south, and when you get to the top of Israel in the Galilean area, they go east and west, and the ranges aren't as defined, but they're ridges and they're valleys, and that's really what we're going to walk on or find. You see, we're in one of these valleys or plateau areas, And we're quite a ways above sea level here, because when you get down to the South Sea of Galilee, we are below sea level 600 feet. So I just show you these pictures as an example of what kind of plains there are. And these are the areas that Jesus would have walked through as he would have gone from Nazareth to Capernaum. I think that probably the event at Nazareth ended his ministry in Nazareth. I think from then on his headquarters was at Capernaum, is the way I understand it. Now, they're making this road between here and, well, we've been on this road for a while, but I have a video here that I pick up, and we're going to show you a little bit of it, if it would work. Yeah, there we go. It's a video of it, and I'm not going to show you all of it because of the time, but it gives you an idea what the land looks like, and is really open. It is not terribly farmable unless you have a valley, and it continues its slow descent, especially at the end of this trip. And they're constructing this into a major thoroughfare, because on the left-hand side, you will see they're building additional lanes to this road. And these roads are improved, and they become very essential to the military defense of the nation, because like in the War of Yom Kippur in 1973, they had a hard time getting people to the battle zone. So they have corrected that by building roads, and are building these roads that are not for tourists. They're actually for military. Of course, the tourists get to drive on them. And I don't know that we come up on it soon, but we'll find there's construction on this road. And if you look on a map, you'll find that this area is the dotted road, and it's the one that's under construction there. Now you see some on the right, the billion overpass here. So let me just let this run for a little bit here. It actually is 4 minutes if I let the whole thing go. But sometimes watching a video is kind of boring, but we'll do a little bit of it. And we see the cloud in the distance. That's over Mount Hermon. And it's interesting that it's almost like the mountain is captivated the cloud, or the cloud captivated the mountain, whichever the way it is. And I thought, well, I wonder why that is. And I thought, well, probably because Mount Hermon is at 9,000 feet, and that has snow on it, all year round. And so wherever you have a cold temperature, you have precipitation. I mean, water precipitates, and it forms clouds. Now, I think that's the answer, because it's just around Mount Hermon that you see these clouds. In some ways, they look like they're 100 miles away, but they're really not that far. If we get closer to Tiberias, that those clouds come really quite close. And so anyway, it's one of those kind of phenomenal things. I mentioned the cloud because it's kind of a round cloud, and our guide said, well, it's over Mount Hermon. That's what it is. So here you go. I'm going to try to jump ahead to the next one. There's see a little bit of construction on the side there. If I can get to the next one. There's supposed to be a way to do this. There we go. This runs about 3 minutes, and we will end up at Tiberias. In fact, you can see on the horizon already the lake. And on the right, come around the bush here. This is Mount Arbel. We'll be up here at our lesson next week and overlook this ministry area of Jesus. So my favorite spot of all in Israel is to go up on the mountain and see that, because you can see so much of the Galilean ministry. Now, some of you are interested in other history. Behind us on our left, we find the Horns of Hattin, where the Crusaders were defeated by the Muslims. And that is in this area. I don't have a picture this time. I'll show it to you when we're up here again on Mount Arbel looking back. So you can see the Galilee 600 feet below sea level. And on the other side, you see the Golan Heights. You cannot see the Jordanian mountains. They would be higher, but this is called the Golan Heights. And we'll visit there, and we'll take a look back across the sea towards Tiberias, and that'll be in a later trip or later lesson. But you see, there's nothing except a beautiful scenery, a little bit bare. It's difficult to live in places where they're just rock. So you find the lower levels, lower plateaus where cities and villages are built, and that's where the farming industry goes. There's probably some sheep herding going on, but that's not quite the industry it used to be. Just watch it run out here. The last couple of minutes, we get close to Arbel here. I have run my GoPro here to do this, just mounted it on the bus, and didn't realize I needed to take it out of a case, because if it's in a case, it can't hear the audio. I mean, it has to have a case that has holes in it, duh. So we have a bus driver, or the, I should say our guide, talking to us, but I can't let you hear it because it's covered up. Not that he was talking all the time, but it was why it's quiet. I just hear the rattling of the case rather than hearing him talk. The bus drivers do a wonderful job, and the roads are built for buses and transportation, a lot of people. You see banana trees, you see orange trees, lemon trees, avocados, of course, olives, wildlife. We've seen fox. We've seen, of course, a lot of different kind of birds we don't see here because we're really tropical in our climate. We just saw the sign go by. It said Migdal, which is place where Merig, I can't even say her name now. Got Migdal in my mind now because that's the Tower of the Flock. So Magdala, there, that's what I'm trying to say, Magdalene. And that now is open for visitation by tourists. So we come to the stop here, make a left, and the video is over. But you can see we're low enough now that you almost cannot see the Sea of Galilee. 600 feet below sea level. And it's pretty well maintained, its elevation. It has come up a little bit. There were some years, about 10 years ago, it was very, very dry, and it dropped some. So in the last few years, it has come up some because it mostly has to have more rain. That's the only place it can come from, and they are desalinizing a lot of the water. So anyway, take one more look at the mountain over the Mount Hermon, and we'll end it there for the evening. Next week, we will. This is Mount Arbel, and the road we just drove on is this one right here. And we'll take a better look at it next week. All right, see you then.